Really? Sanford and Sons theme? Do you know who wrote that?
No, who?
Quincy Jones.
Shut up, really?
Yep. Is this what people tune in for?
Wait, are we rolling? We're rolling.
Oh, we've been rolling since Jump Street.
Damn it. Okay. Say, hey, Bill.
Yes, Jeffrey.
Happy anniversary, buddy.
Oh, really?
It's like that.
Wait, is it our anniversary, really?
52.
52 episodes. We've been doing this for a year.
A year, 52.
A full 52. Year.
This is the On Taking Pictures anniversary show.
Yeah. Hey, you know what we should do? Well, first of all, you should say who we are, and then we'll
Okay. My name is Jeffrey Sidoris from fadedandblurred.com. Maybe you've heard of it, and if you haven't, you should.
Best photography website on the internet.
I think so. Thank you. With me, my partner in anniversary-ness, fancy New York photographer, Bill Wadman.
Hello, Jeffrey. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Can I start with a story? I have a story.
Sure.
Real quick story. A friend of mine who I've known since high school, up in the wine country, Northern California, celebrating, she and her sister were celebrating with their mother. It was their mother's 70th birthday. And I hope she doesn't mind me saying that. But hired a photographer, local photographer, to shoot some portraits, some family portraits.
Okay.
And she asked him, you know, you're a photographer. Hey, do you know this site, fadedandblurred.com? Really, you know, really great for photography inspiration, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, yeah, yeah. He's like, I love the site. How do you know this? And she's like, oh, a friend of mine runs it. And he's like, you know Jeffrey Sidoris? And I just thought that was so cute. I was like, wait, what? You know, because we're knuckleheads, right?
Yeah, right.
And I just thought it was very cute that even in the wine country of California, you know, we've got juice.
Well, you know, somebody asked on
I didn't even mean to do that.
Oh, I see. There's a joke. That was a pun, as they say.
Wine juice.
I wanted. Somebody was asking on the Google Plus group,
right?
How this all got started?
Oh, our origin story.
Yeah.
To put it in the comic vernacular,
right? So and it was funny because somebody's just like, and then I realized that On Taking Pictures was originally Bill's blog, which is true.
Yeah. Yeah.
So here's what happened. I was doing another podcast called Circuitous Conversations with my friend Dan Gottesman.
And which is very cool, but very techie.
Very techie, right? Yeah. And yep. We did about 100 episodes, so if you want to go listen to techie, nerdy stuff, they're there on iTunes and circuitous.tv.
Yeah, they spent a whole hour talking about Delta E.
Actually, I don't know if we ever did. But we should have if we didn't.
I thought you did. Wasn't that in the monitor show?
Oh, maybe we did do a monitor show.
You did a monitor show.
Oh, that was probably a good episode. We should link to that. Anyway, so Jeffrey wrote me out of the blue because you were doing a podcast where you're interviewing photographers, correct?
Right, right.
And Nikki suggested me because she had seen my 365 portraits project. Because a friend of mine named Jonathan Gorman out in California is somehow friends with Nikki on the internet and suggested she look at my day-long project because she was doing one at the time.
Right. Yeah, she was doing one and Jonathan saw it and said, hey, you should check out my friend Bill.
We still have yet to figure out how your girlfriend and my friend Jonathan know each other.
Yeah, I'm still unsure how that connection happened.
Okay, anyway, long and short of it is that I said sure because I'm a media whore. Actually, no, I'm not. In the grand scheme of photographers who are out there in public, I am not even on the scale.
Yeah, your whoredom is very low.
Yeah, yeah. Every once in a while when I can't make rent,
we'll go on tour.
Yeah. So we did a show for you, which we should also put in the show notes.
Yeah, the first interview show. Yeah,
yeah. And then we stayed in touch, and then you came on as a guest on Circuitous,
right?
At one point, and then I decided I wanted to start a new podcast about photography specifically, and not really a big gear show. I toyed with doing it with a number of people, and I did some sort of,
I had to audition. That was the thing.
I did some sort of beta auditioning kind of things. In fact, I was thinking about releasing those audition episodes as special episodes.
They're like old Mouseketeer episodes.
Yeah. Something like that. Cause we did, you know, I did one with my friend Randy. I think I did one with, our good friend of the show, Gary Yost, and they're good. They're really good episodes, actually. I should put those out there.
Gary's got a great voice.
Why did I choose you again?
I don't know. Gary's got a great speaking voice.
He does. He's fantastic. That man is just...
I love his narration of his time-lapse, which are amazing, by the way, his time-lapses that he's doing up on... What is that mountain? What is...
That would be Mount Tamalpais.
Tamalpais, yeah.
Yeah. Behold the turkey vulture. Yeah. Gary is like, you know... Top 10 people in the world, as far as I'm concerned, and very, very happy to have met him.
What do they call people like that? Smart cookies.
He is a smart cookie and a total sweetheart. And then, so you and I did one, and it came out good, and so we started the show.
Yeah.
And I wanted to call it On Taking Pictures, actually, originally, because Dan Benjamin suggested that I start a photo podcast called On Taking Pictures.
Dan Benjamin?
Yeah.
Of the 5x5?
Of the 5x5 network, said, you should do a podcast called On Taking Pictures.
Look at him.
And I said, that's a good idea. And so that's how it all came apart. So yes, On Taking Pictures.
Came apart?
That's how it came apart.
That's how it all came apart. That was the beginning of the end.
That's how it ended. So yes, I used to have, I have a website called ontakingpictures.com, which is originally my blog that I started in 2008. So yes, that's all the info.
So there it is.
Now we are a year in. And,
it's so weird. Honestly, it's so weird to think about that we've done 51 of these so far.
Yeah, 51.1.
Right. Huh.
It's weird.
So
yeah, there are 75 hours. You could listen to us talk for 2 days straight. I don't know why you would ever want to do that. Or actually 4 days straight.
It's like, wait, are there only... Wait a minute.
Wow, that would be a feat.
4 days.
Yeah. But I like when people write us and they're like, just found the show and I'm catching up and I'm listening to like 6 episodes a day. Oh, and I was like,
God help you.
What is wrong with you?
Yeah, take a break.
Go outside, eat something, consider sleeping. Anyway, so... That's good. Yes, anniversary. We're year in, and here's to another year.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
So where do you want to start?
But you've got some cryptic things in the notes, so I'm going to follow your lead.
Okay. I wanted to follow up on last week.
Yes.
Last week we discussed doing personal projects in order to get work. We discussed being a solo photographer versus having a team of people.
Right.
We talked about a lot of things. And I was cranky.
Were you?
No, I was cranky.
Oh, I'm sorry. I hadn't noticed.
No, so yeah. So I was
salty,
a little cranky.
I think people referred to you as.
Yeah, lighter-esque.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Salty. Yeah. Okay.
So I wanted to say a few things. Number one. I'm sorry I was cranky last week. Number two, I think that personal work is a fantastic thing, and yes, it leads to future work. So does everything you do, right?
Sure. Yeah, everything builds in some manner.
Yes, every decision you make in your life is leading to whatever comes after it in some small way.
I don't think you can. Personally, I don't think you can look at personal work as if I do this, then I'm going to get hired to do this.
Exactly.
I think you have to do the work for the work.
Yes. Okay. So that's what I wanted to talk about, right?
Okay.
I wanted to say that you can't go into doing personal projects and thinking, I'm going to do this, and when I'm done, X will happen. It's like, no, with personal work, the journey is very much the reward.
Sure.
And if you get something out of it after the fact, that's super. But drawing a straight line between those things is most likely not going to happen. And if it does, right. It's a fluke.
Right. You don't have any control. You have very little control over what happens to the work once you release it into the wild.
Right. Right.
You know, and you have seen this time and time again, where you put up something that you think almost as a lark, but that's getting comments, traffic, questions. Meanwhile, this something that you've worked your butt off on goes unnoticed.
Yeah, absolutely. Happens all the time.
Yeah.
So I guess I just wanted to discuss that a little bit, if that's possible. Is that all we need to say about it?
I don't know.
I just felt like last week.
Why do you think you need to address it? Why do you, what happened last week that you think?
Because I feel like I sounded really cranky last week, and I think you sounded a little, bubbly last week about it.
Bubbly?
I couldn't come up with a better word. You were very much like, yeah, rah, rah, cheerleader. And I was kind of like, bah, this sucks. And I think that the truth is somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
Right. But I think that you definitely like that if you're trying to think of some project that you can do. Okay. There are people who are looking to do a personal project or whatever, coming up with an idea and doing it in such a way that they're looking for something that's going to get noticed.
Mm-hmm.
That bothers me somehow. You know,
so you're doing the idea of doing the project just for the accolades or the juice on it rather than for its own.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, I'm going to do this thing and it's going to involve autism because autism is gets a lot of notice.
Okay.
You know, or I'm going to go up to Boston and shoot, you know, like all this bombing and stuff, all this crazy stuff last week, which is a whole other thing. You know, and I'm gonna do a series of portraits of people in Boston because that's what people want to see right now. Like, that kind of stuff bothers me. That is, you know, we've talked a lot about the whole idea of being what's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know.
We were talking about, you know, when you go shoot the people in Kentucky and all that kind of stuff.
We've done entire shows about
exploitation.
Oh, exploitation. Okay, like the Walker Evans type things. Yeah, yeah. Okay, okay.
I mean, we've discussed that a number of times on shows. But like the idea of having the goal that people notice it be the one of the reasons why you choose a particular subject feels wrong to me.
Mm-hmm.
If it happens to be the thing that you're interested in is something that a lot of people are interested in, then fine. But if your intention is to get noticed and that's why you're choosing a particular subject or a particular project, that I don't know, there's something about that makes me feel weird. Is that just me, or is that?
I don't know. I mean,
it's probably the smart thing to do.
Maybe. I've got a few projects that I've been working on for a while, and what I've found is that if I just have an idea and act on it immediately, often it doesn't work out very well. But if I create a folder, or in my case, I have several notebooks that I write in, and I write down ideas that I have, and I find that if I've come back to them several times,
right,
then there's something to it.
You know what's interesting about that? I work the exact opposite way.
Really?
Yeah. Like, my best stuff is when I literally threw myself in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I said, you know what, I'm going to start doing this thing for a year and I'm going to start today. Where's my camera?
Right.
Those are the times that I do my best work, when I'm just like, screw it, I'm going to go do it and figure it out as I go along.
See, I'm a research junkie. I love doing the research. I mean, look, we how many times did we talk about me buying a camera? It took forever.
You were thinking about buying a camera?
The first new car I bought was a nightmare. I mean, I drove every car I could multiple times, to the point where people at several dealerships knew who I was. You know, and they're like,
hated you.
Yeah, you want to drive it again? Yeah, I do. You know, but on the other side of that, I don't have buyer's remorse ever. You know, okay. I don't have regrets about jumping into something because I think I've done the diligence on it beforehand.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, I just
now, sometimes I wish I could do it differently. Sometimes I wish I could just get an idea and go all in on something.
Well, maybe this proves that my reasoning is wrong. That, you know, maybe for some people, the idea of having the notoriety or the subject that's going to be an interesting thing that people are going to notice, starting with that is the way for them to work, mm-hmm. you know? Because obviously you and I go at things very differently. I just sort of jump in and figure it out as I go along, sink or swim, where you like to plan.
Right.
I don't
know if it's plan as much as it's experiment.
It's simmer.
Yeah. I noodle.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
the question is, what percentage of your things do you actually finish, quote unquote?
A low percentage of things I actually finish, but when I do finish them, I think I'm very proud of them, by and large.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to get back to it, I think that everything you do as an artist, everything you do as a person, certainly, but everything you do as an artist is leading to the next thing. It's like that Sliding Doors movie, right? Gwyneth Paltrow. That's not a bad movie. I like the Scottish guy in that, the guy who's in Four Weddings and a Funeral too.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not a huge Gwyneth Paltrow fan.
No, but I like the concept of that movie. I have to go watch it again. Anyway.
Although she is good in Iron Man.
Yeah, well, there you go. used to know a girl who went to high school with her, said she was a giant nightmare. But anyway, I think that there is... building a future, building a career... is a step-by-step process, and I don't know that there are any shortcuts. You know, you and I talk a lot in the show about, oh, you could do this, you could do these projects, oh, you can try that, you could talk to people, you can, you know, show your work and get critiques and stuff. It still takes all of that time to get there, you know?
Sure.
And I think even the people that you've talked to, I mean, you've talked to Keatley and what's the other guy's name?
Jeff Newton.
And, you know, and we've talked about them because they're doing well and getting work and whatever it is. But also at other times in conversations about them with me on and off the show, you've talked about how many years they've been doing this and how much work they've put in.
Yeah, doing the work may not result in a career, but doing the work will result in a body of work.
Yes. Do you think that that's the problem with some people? Is that some people think that it automatically will work out?
Yes.
I mean,
I think that there is this idea that if I do the work, it's going to lead to something. But it may not.
Yeah. That email from Ken sort of alludes to that.
Yes. We were going to save that for late. Let's address that for a minute.
Do you think it's a good time?
What do you think? Yeah, let's do it. Let's break protocol.
So we've been going back and forth with a listener. Did he write you first or us first? Oh, I guess
he just wrote the show.
He just wrote the show.
I believe so.
Podcast at ontakingpictures.com if you guys want to write in. Saying that he switched over to Squarespace. He used the promo code. So thank you very much, Ken. And we were talking about, he was recommending Annie Dillard's The Writing Life.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a potter. He makes pottery, this guy.
Beautiful stuff.
Absolutely beautiful stuff. Yeah.
I want that green mug. There's a green mug with a blue, oh, beautiful.
I'm sure if you're nice to Ken, you could probably make that happen. So we went back and forth and we said it was lovely work and whatever. And he said, he was talking about how he made the move from being having a job to doing pottery. Not that doing pottery or artistic work isn't a job, but he had a job where he had a boss.
Right.
And now he has a job where he doesn't have a boss.
Very different. I mean, six-figure income.
Yep.
doing user interface design, software design, that kind of thing.
Right.
Huge jump.
Right. But what I found interesting about it was that I'm gonna read a few sentences from his thing. He said,
"Yeah, go ahead."
There is this notion in American work culture that we are all independent players capable of quote anything, and we only need to summon courage to be able to strike out new directions. I think the reality is a little more complex. Background matters. Your family matters. Debt and expenses matter. Change is possible, but it's a long-term project, and you need to prepare. You need to invest in yourself and your relationships.
Absolutely.
Of course, your mileage may vary.
I believe that 100%.
You know, that's sort of your whole thing where you're never going to play in the NBA.
Right.
The question is, how do you know where your limits are and when you should cut your losses?
I think that's just something you have to work through for yourself. Now, I may not play in the NBA, but that doesn't mean that
I can't play a mean game of basketball.
That's right. That doesn't mean I couldn't surround myself with people who are in the NBA and glean insight and stories and narratives from their experiences. And drink their Cristal. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I mean, I'm in a position where I wouldn't necessarily call myself a photographer by any means, but I'm immersed in photography. I'm surrounded by photographers, and I get to talk to photographers and artists and writers and craftspeople and listen to their stories and then share those stories that inspire me with the rest of you.
That's entirely true. But, you know, as we talked about after the show last week, you were also taking something of a skewed sample.
Sure.
You know, you're talking to the people who have made it. It's sort of like...
Not entirely true.
Okay.
I do talk to them.
When Anne Hathaway goes on in the Actors Studio and they say, oh, you know, look, you've won Academy Awards and whatever. And like, you know, how'd you do it? And she says, oh, I worked really hard and I, you know... And it's like, okay, well, lots of people work really hard. Not all of them win Academy Awards, right?
Right.
So if all you ever talk to is Tom Hanks and I was going to say Charles Nelson Reilly.
Oh!
I don't know where that came from.
Love Charles Nelson Reilly.
If all you talk to is, you know, Harrison Ford and George Clooney and Annette Bening.
How do you go from Tom Hanks to Charles Nelson Reilly?
I think it's because...
What are you...
But if all you ever talk to are the people who are stars and they say, oh, the way to be a star is to work really hard, do you think that all you have to do is work really hard to be a star?
I can't imagine that there are too many people out there that actually believe that.
I believe that.
You believe that all you have to do is work hard?
I want to believe that.
Sure, you want to, but you know the reality is not that. Working hard is a necessary component, but working hard doesn't beget success.
Yeah, you know, this is sort of the I was lost at sea and I prayed to God to save me and here I am. He saved me. And it's like, well, yeah, but if you didn't survive, then you wouldn't be here to say that he didn't save you, you know. So
sure.
It's sort of there's this part of the battle that says that, you know, successful people say that these are the things you need to do to be successful, but that doesn't mean that doing those things will make you successful.
No, there's a pretty fair amount of dumb luck in it too.
Yeah, and that part of it, I will admit, upsets me personally.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want it to be a meritocracy, you know? I want the best people to get the jobs. I want the people who do the best work are the people who deserve it the most. Well, that becomes a whole thing. Deserving. What does deserving mean? You know, I have 6 kids to feed, so I deserve this job more than the guy who has, you know, money in the bank. Even though the guy who has money in the bank might be better at the job, you know?
Right. Well, look, things have changed a little bit in the photography and the art world, in that sometimes you're not hiring the photographer or the artist. Sometimes you're hiring what they bring with them.
Isn't that always been the case, though?
I think so, but it's more immediate now. I mean, yes, if you hired somebody, you know, let's say you hired a photographer in the 80s.
Right.
Let's say you hired Herb Ritts.
Right.
Herb Ritts had a certain amount of.
Can we call it cachet?
Yeah, sure. Juice around him. But, you know, now social media and the amount of reach that a photographer can leverage or potentially leverage is immense.
The funny thing is, though, okay, let's take some big quote unquote celebrity photographer, not people who shoot celebrities, but people who think themselves are celebrities, you know, the Chase Jarvises of the world, right?
Okay.
Chase Jarvis has a big thing. He's got his Creative Live. He's got all the rest of it. But so let's say you go hire him because you think that your stuff's going to get out there more if you hire him to do it, right?
Which I'm sure is the case.
Okay. But who is he talking to? He's just talking to other photographers. So what the hell does that do for you? You know? Ooh, I know that Chase Jarvis shot something for a snowboard company. What difference does that make to the snowboard company if a bunch of photographers know? See what I'm saying?
I think because we're all consumers.
Consumers of what? Snowboards?
Of everything. You don't know.
Yeah, I guess so. But I don't know. I don't know that actually equates with action. It's like, I don't know that Oreos sells more cookies because they have a million people on Facebook who say they like Oreos. You know?
Yeah. So you're saying that the reach has no bearing on who gets hired? I don't agree with that at all.
I think it has bearing on who gets hired. I wonder if it's an actual advantage to hire that person for that reason is my question.
Okay, are there measurable metrics
exactly
to support it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It may be an illusion. It may be the illusion that if I hire you and you've got 5 million followers, that the results of me hiring you are somehow going to be better or more effective than if you had, you know, I hired somebody else who had 100,000 followers.
Right.
I mean, look, ultimately it's you're hiring the tribe. You're hiring, you know, the village surrounding that person.
Okay,
in some cases.
Is that just right? Is that a thing right now? Because social media is hot, or is that
probably
a reality?
I think it's probably a little of both.
There is so much fashion in all of these businesses. And I don't mean fashion as in clothes.
Right.
You know, there's so much people grasping for what the next big thing is.
Sure.
You know,
and everybody's looking at the hit counter.
Yeah.
Everybody's looking at not everybody. Too many people are looking at what are my stats? What are my hits? Who's talking about me? Who's doing this? Who's doing that?
Yeah.
And look, I'm a huge fan of Seth Godin, and one of my favorite talks by him, he addresses this specifically of how much time is wasted looking at hits on a website or looking at views on a portfolio page rather than building a relationship. And he boils it down to basically.
Okay, hold on a second. Says the guy with 262,000 followers.
Yeah, but he didn't start that way.
Okay. Well, no one starts that way. Go ahead. Finish your thing.
It's this idea of you go out of your way for someone, and someone is going to go out of their way for you.
Okay.
And I don't think you can reduce it to, you know, well, says the guy with two. Well, yeah, he has that now. But before he started giving away books for free or giving away content for free, or, you know, he had to take action in a different way to get where he is.
Right. But you could, I mean, what's interesting about it though, is that, for example, Seth Godin, his Wikipedia page, his first thing isn't author or public speaker. It's American entrepreneur.
Okay.
So he's just another guy trying to find another way to make money. His way of making money is to talk about giving away things for free. So obviously he's making money somehow. Well, he's talking about giving away things for free
doesn't work.
Right.
There's got to be more to it. I mean, we've been giving away content and writing content, and we've been producing content for Faded and Blurred for over 3 years. I don't have the same following as Petapixel or F-Stoppers, or I don't have anywhere near that.
You should.
Well,
you should have twice the followers of both of them.
That's, well, thank you. But that's neither here nor there. I would rather have a vibrant community. You know, look at our G Plus group, for example.
Right.
360 odd members.
Okay.
But they're talking, they're communicating, they're engaging.
Yeah. True.
I'd rather have that than have 10,000 people with only 5 people posting over and over and over and over again.
Right.
So it's this idea of community and relationship is, I think, important. And it is core to where we are right now in how to do business and how to promote yourself.
Okay, but here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you suddenly had 10 times or 100 times the traffic on your site,
right?
What would make you feel positive about that? The fact that that could lead to more marketing dollars, or because that would just lead to a greater conversation?
I don't know because I've given up on watching it. All I do is I put up things that interest me. We write about things that inspire us, both Nikki and I.
Yes.
Whether it's a paragraph, a page, or, 2,000 words about Gordon Parks.
Okay, Faden and Blurred may be a good case study here, right? Because you are creating, people always say, oh, just make good content and people will come.
Nope.
You make excellent content and you don't have as many viewers as you would like or think you should have.
Right.
So what's wrong? What are we all doing wrong?
I have no idea.
And what are the people who have 4 million followers who are just shilling product to people have? What are they doing right? You know, what part of human psychology are all these people just playing on human psychology in a way that's advantageous to them?
I don't know. I mean, and to be honest with you, I've almost given up trying to figure it out because we've been trying to figure it out. And at the end of the day, I don't want to
play that game.
Yeah. I don't want to pander to a hit counter. Mm-hmm. I want to keep doing the things that interest me.
Yeah.
You know, so I do this show because it interests me. If it gets 5,000 listeners, 10,000 listeners, or 100,000 listeners, that's not going to determine how much I enjoy doing it. What I enjoy is the content, the interaction, the banter, the wordplay. That's what I enjoy.
Sure.
And it's the same thing that I enjoy about doing things for Faded and Blurred. It's why I want to do more content. And we've got some things that we've been working on for a while that I think are going to be fun. And if somebody else does, that's great. But ultimately, I have to love what I'm doing. It doesn't. If 100,000 people like it, but I hate doing it every week, what's the point?
Right.
And I'm extraordinarily lucky that I get to make those decisions and go, well, you know, I do want to do this or I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
And I make no, pretense about how lucky I am to be able to do that. But in terms of trying to figure out why, I've given up on that because I don't know that there is no, to your point, work hard, you're going to be a successful actor. Put up good content, you're going to get, 100,000 people following you. Doesn't equate.
Right. Sure. Yeah. There's crazy, hipster teenagers who have 100 times the amount of followers on Twitter that I have.
Yeah.
Right.
And it goes back to your work. You work on some project that you think is amazingly personal and important, and you put a ton of time into it. And at the same time, you put up a picture of a cat in an MRI machine.
Yeah.
And the cat in the MRI machine gets, 580,000 comments.
Yeah. True.
You know what I mean?
No, it's true. So you're the internet loves cats.
Yeah. And you're left going, what the heck?
Why do I bother?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I do that all the time. I mean, sometimes I think, why am I on Facebook? I mean, I don't care about 90% of the stuff that's on there because it's all terrible retweets or it's George Takei or, that kind of thing, which is great. And they're very funny. But like, did that really add anything to my life? And okay, yeah, I can put my stuff up there. And yeah, I put up this picture I did yesterday. This,
Hadouken. How do you pronounce that? What is that?
Hadouken? I don't know. And then there's a whole other name for it, too. Makankosapo? Makankosapo? Which is, it's all these, like, you know, fake sort of fighting things, right? So I did one, and I put it up, and it got, like, you know, 80 likes or whatever it is on Facebook. And I'm like, okay. And? Why did I bother? Well, Not why did I bother making it, but why do I bother posting it on Facebook so that people can see it? Because I think that somebody on Facebook is going to share it with somebody, and they're going to go, oh, wow, I'm doing a new thing for Dove, and I want to, you know, have somebody fighting it. I'm going to hire that guy. That's the carrot. Whether or not I've never heard of that actually happening to somebody that I've met who can prove that that's why it happened.
I have.
You have. Okay. See, yes. I've never gotten work from stuff that's been shared like that.
I know of, and I'm not going to name this person, but I know of a photographer who got a very large campaign from work that was posted on Facebook.
Okay. I think that that's I think that is a marginal case, though.
Right. And I'm not saying that it's not, but it is the carrot.
Yeah, well, that's the dream, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh my God, people are going to see how wonderful I am at retouching and compositing, and they're going to want me, you know, to give me, you know, a Maserati and a.
No, but look, there are other Miss Aniela, do you know her?
No.
Started posting self portraits on Flickr, and people started seeing it. It turned into a thing and led her to another level in her career.
Right.
I think even Aaron Nace from Flern, his whole beginnings with Rosie Hardy and their whole interaction, that helped certainly to get his work noticed. And I would imagine, I haven't talked to him, but I would imagine that helped at least pave the way in some way to launch Flern,
right,
which is a great resource.
I think that again, this is a skewed sample.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the 10 people that this happened to.
Look, history is written by the winners.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but is, you know, by doing what the winners did, it makes people think that they're going to be winners too. And I think a lot of this is just luck. I mean, it's doing good work and it's meeting the right person at the right time in the right place, and that there might not be more to it than that.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, luck favors the bold, or, you know, the muse has to find you working and all that kind of stuff. It's just another way to say, just keep doing it, 'cause maybe you'll get lucky.
I think there is luck to be included in there. There's talent, there's skill, there's passion, there's drive. There are all these things. There is no, you know, take the blue pill, you'll be successful. Take the red pill, you won't.
Buzzword, buzzword, buzzword.
You think all of those things are buzzwords?
I think that they are true in the sense that they're true, but they're also somewhat self-evident.
Okay, so the idea
you need to work hard at something to get good at it. It's like, yeah. Tell me something I don't know.
So the sort of Tony Robbins-esque way of finding someone who is living the kind of life that you want to live, find out what they did, do the same thing, and you'll get similar results. You don't buy into that?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
I wish it were that way. I don't know. I just haven't found that to be true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I the work that I do for my personal stuff is a lot of this conceptual stuff. And yeah, you know, I sell a few prints or whatever, but I'm definitely not making a living doing that kind of stuff. I'm good enough at it that you would think that after showing it to a bunch of people, at least someone would want me to do that. But no, they want me to take straight portraits, which is fine. I'm good at that. I like doing that too. But it's sort of the idea that, like, is it because I'm no good at doing what I do, what I want to do? Maybe. Maybe I'm just not good enough at it, and that's why people aren't hiring me.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that that's true, you know? And this isn't me whining. It's just, I'm just being realistic, right?
Sure.
It's the whole thing is fascinating to me.
Oh, it's incredibly fascinating. These are the kinds of discussions that I love having.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
When big things do happen, you know, when you do get the call that leads to all this kind of stuff, you know, sometimes you get, you start to backfill reasoning. You start to say, oh, you know, this happened because of this, and this.
Right,
and it's
right.
like, you
this
know.
This is why I'm getting this.
Right.
But you never know.
Right, exactly. Right. And you work really hard, and then I don't know if that's because I am a very sort of cyclical person, mm-hmm. to where when I'm on a high, when I'm on a roll, nothing can stop me.
Okay, but
and when I'm stalled, I feel like I'm never going to get started again.
But even this idea of, as you just said, the backfill reasoning, if you could nail down, this is why I succeeded, then you would only ever do that.
Right.
So and, your experience here, and you
try
only get
to replicate
one that we
it.
Know of, it would be very limited.
Right. Right. And, but even if you try to recreate it, it doesn't happen.
Sure.
You know, it doesn't work that way. So it's all very, very interesting. I remember I read, when I was first getting into photography, I talked to a friend who was a professional photographer, and he was pretty good. I can't remember his name at the moment. This was years ago. And, he agreed to talk to me on the phone. Like, you know, I get calls or emails from students or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to him on the phone and he gave me some advice. He said, you know, if you get a big job, don't go buy a house, put it in the bank. Basically, like, you know, if suddenly you get some job for $150,000, don't put it as a down payment on a house that you have to, you know, pay the mortgage on.
Right.
Just hold on to the money because it may not come again ever.
Yeah. Okay.
And
all right.
I've been in those situations where I've had a big job and made a bunch of money and then done nothing for 6 months.
And did you keep the money?
I kept the money and then I lived off the money for six months, you know.
Yeah, I don't think there's nothing wrong with that. I got very similar advice from my dentist. He said, you know, play with 10%, save the rest.
Right. And they're dentist. That's, yeah. But you know what? A guy who becomes a dentist is probably not the most like risk taking person on earth, right?
I don't know. I thought it was good advice though.
It is.
Go play with 10%, save the rest.
It's very conservative advice. But you know, dentists never change the world. You know?
I was waiting to see if you were going to type that in as a title.
I am.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Yeah, no, you're right.
So
maybe.
So
I don't know.
So where,
maybe they did.
You know, we've got one run through this. I mean, back to that email from Ken. I mean, he also talks about, you know, look, if you want to do this, you need to get rid of debt and live simply and all these kinds of things, which are all true. Low mm-hmm. expenses means more freedom is one of his things, and that's absolutely true. But low expenses also means that you haven't invested in a mortgage and all that kind of stuff, because that's the kind of stuff that ties you down and makes sure you have to have enough money to pay that big check every month or whatever, right?
Right.
You know, the majority of debt that people have now is debt that they've taken on so that they could have a car and a house and school. So, okay, well, if I don't have those things, then what happens when I can't work anymore at age 70? You know?
Right.
So you get into these, I tend to side on his side when it comes to this stuff. You know, I don't live a glamorous life. I mean, I have a fine apartment. I live in Brooklyn. I am in the top 1% of the world. You know, I'm very lucky. You know, if I want pizza for lunch, I'll go get pizza. If I want to go get a steak, I'll go get a steak. You know, like I can do that. I have all of that freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have the freedom to just say, you know what, screw it. I'm going to go live in Malibu for the rest of my life. Sit on the beach, you know. I don't have the freedom to go hop on a plane right now. I mean, I guess I could if I really wanted to, but, you know, I'd stick it on my credit card. I don't have tens of thousands of dollars sitting in a bank account just to run away with.
And you would stress about it. You wouldn't
would
just go, oh, well,
right.
yeah, let's do that.
Now, I am happy where I am. do I see people that I'm envious of because they're doing really well for whatever reason? Yeah. Are some of them doing well because they're doing really conservative things? They've gone and become dentists and therefore they're doing well.
But again, you're using, I mean, you're almost romanticizing that same argument of you're just looking at the people that are, you're seeing the results of it. You don't see their day to day that they're living with.
Yeah. And I don't see, you know, them and their wives or husbands when they're all cranky because they just come home from work and they don't like their jobs. And
right.
I mean, you so and would you, you and want I have to lived
chase
that
thing?
No, I chased that thing for 10 years.
Yeah. And it, I mean, look, there's a story, quick Elvis Presley story. Because I'm a huge fan.
There's no such thing as a quick Elvis Presley story.
No, it was really quick. July 31st, 1969, the International Hotel was supposedly the show that he chased his entire career subsequent to that.
Okay.
It was the one night where he felt everything went right. He was, you know, on point, on stage, on fire, all of it. And he chased that for the rest of his life.
His Apollo moment.
Yeah. And coincidentally, my mother was in the audience. But what did I wonder if that show had not gone the way that it did, how his life may have been different.
Hmm.
Do you know, if you have that one moment where everything lined up perfectly, the stars aligned and you got the big job or you got the gallery show or you got the whatever.
Yep.
And you try and duplicate that for the rest of your life, what do you miss out on? Because all you're trying to do is chase that moment.
True. Look, I've had the big job and I've had the gallery show.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like once it's over, I'm right back where I started. It's like the people who think that, oh, I'm going to have this big wedding because like that's going to change my life. And then the big wedding happens and they've spent $20,000 on a party. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then they're like right back the next day, they're like sitting down watching Mad Men again. And they're like, wait a minute.
How are we going to pay for this party?
Yeah. Right. and there's definitely some of that even in the work that you do, you know, you're not always going to be rocking and rolling. But I think you have to, the whole thing is it's a long game, you know, mm-hmm. like Ken was saying, you have to think, you know what, like I'm going to make these fundamental changes to my life so that I can do what I love.
Right.
If then I become really successful at doing what I love and can then, you know, bring back all of those things that I gave up because largely those things are material things, right? That we're talking about. That I can, you know, get that nice car again because I'm really successful.
Right.
That's great, you know?
Yeah. No, but, and I love the idea of you saying that it's the long game. And in Ken's email, there's one line that really kind of stuck out for me. And it says, there wasn't any one heroic act of will.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a great idea. It's a fantastic metaphor.
But there was a moment where he made a decision to take the first step on that road.
Sure.
And that in itself is a big thing.
Absolutely. Wow. What a great email. Thank you so much, Ken.
Yeah. Big topic for discussion. Are we done with this for now? We could go on forever on this topic.
I think so.
Okay.
Ken's probably tired of hearing about his email anyway.
I like that. That's good. Do you want to talk about Shutterstock?
More than anything.
You really do?
I want to talk about the 27 pieces of stock photos, vectors, and illustrations. Well,
I got to hold you there. There's more than 27.
Have they added more?
Yeah. In fact, Jeffrey, they add 10,000 a day.
What?
Yeah. They have 20 million stock photos, illustrations,
okay, I was close.
Vectors, and clip art. You had the 20 in there. That's about as close as you were. That's cute, right?
Yeah.
Start your search at shutterstock.com to find that perfect image for your website.
Okay. Now wait a minute.
What?
Wait a minute.
What?
You know the drill. What? We've got to start our search So what do you want to search for? What do you want to search?
Let's say that I gave up my job as a dentist.
Okay.
And became a photographer, but I had to sell my sailboat. But I wanted a picture of a sailboat to go on the post that I put on my blog where I said I was giving up my sailboat.
A sailboat. Bad news.
There are no pictures of sailboats?
They don't have one picture of a sailboat, but they do have 38,999 results.
And I understand there's a way to search by color too. Is that true?
I don't know. Let's search for a red sailboat. 3,036.
Oh, man, how am I going to choose? It's good stuff, right?
It really is.
Look, there's a global collection of images Shutterstock gives you. You can find images from across the world to suit your project. They have image packs where you could buy like one or two or three images. You get these monthly subscription packages, which are great if you run a blog or something and you use pictures all the time. You get one of these subscriptions and you get hundreds of pictures a month.
Right.
You know, you get 25 images a day. If you buy a 1-year subscription, it's a couple hundred bucks a month, but you get 25 images a day. So say you're The Verge, you know, and you need a picture of man with cell phone that goes in every single thing that goes on your site.
Wait. Man with cell phone.
How many?
20,456.
Look, how are you going to choose, right? So you could write 20,000 different posts and have a different image for each one. These people are not messing around.
You could have a blog all about men with cell phones.
It's true.
And have
you could.
Nothing but men with cell phones.
In fact, we just bought menwithcellphones.tumblr.com. You can curate and share your pictures with these with a Lightbox system they have set up, so you can choose your favorite ones, show them to people. You can save them to your Lightbox gallery as you search. There's an iPad app to do all of this. It's fantastic. Yep. You can even do what's called an enhanced license access. So if you want to take an image and run it, do prints on a bag because you're NAB next month or whatever. That was last month, wasn't it? Yeah, I guess it was. You could get this enhanced licensing and print out this picture of the guy with the cell phone on your bag and it's, say, The Verge underneath. They also have a huge library of vectors and icons and infographic templates. I got to make infographics.
You know what? We could get a guy with a cell phone, put it on a bag, and put underneath it. Are you ready?
What?
On talking pictures.
What? They got video clips too, Jeffrey. So let's say you're making a movie. And you need a video shot of a foggy street at night. See if they have something about that. You got any of that in there? I'm making a film noir movie.
Yeah?
Yeah. And I need a street at nighttime.
Foggy street. 78 video clips.
Done.
Nighttime, daytime.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
These people are fantastic. So
foggy weather.
And so you can set up an account for free to go browse. You get an account rep dedicated to you to answer any questions. They got 24-hour support during the week. It's fantastic. So go to shutterstock.com. No credit card needed. Set up a free browse account. And when you decide that you're going to start the blog Men With Cell Phones.
.com.
You can use the offer code PICTURES4. For April, and you'll get 30% off any package that you purchase. And we love Shutterstock.com, and we thank them very much for their support.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, guys. Men with cell phones.
Man, we're getting silly on these ads. I feel like we're like Howard Stern when he reads the ads and he goes off.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Yeah, it's a thing. Hey, I went to the Met the other day.
Do you know the Metropolitan?
The Metropolitan Museum of Art.
I have been there, yes.
There's a book all about the Met, apparently.
There are probably about 5,000 books.
Okay, there is a specific book about the Met that I'm talking about, which is the history of the Met and how the people who gave the money were all slimy, rich people, robber baron guys.
Okay.
And it was all just a scam to, I don't know, save their money or something. I don't know what it was.
Did they not really care about the art?
I can't imagine that rich people really don't care about the art. Yeah. So anyway, I got to read that book. Anyway, so met up with a friend of ours who was having a birthday party in the park. My friend Lindsay.
Well, that's nice.
And the she does this every year. Yeah, Central Park. She gets balloons and she sits in the same place every year. And friends come and see her and then leave. And then, you know, next year she's back there.
She holds court in the park. That's so cool.
Yeah, that's how she does her party. So she sits there for like 6 hours.
Wow.
And people come and go, and there's always like a few people there, and it's fun.
Is there food and things like that?
Yeah, everyone brings food and drink and whatever. And then she has as many balloons as she is old. So things just keep getting happier because she keeps getting more and more balloons every year. Lindsay's quite a gal.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, she's a good girl. So we were right next to the Met, and I was just like, you know what? Okay, here, we're done with this party. Let's go to the Met. I said to Heather. Says I to Heather. And you know, the Met is a suggested donation kind of place.
Sure.
So they suggest $25, but I go to the Met enough that I'm not paying $25 every time I go to the Met. So we go in and I paid like 10 bucks a piece or something, right?
Do they scowl you if you don't?
No, you can even say, I'm going to give a dollar or donate. Can I just have a pin? They have to give it to you.
Interesting.
So, which is good because you know what? Lots of people don't have $25 and they'd be enriched by going to a place like the Met.
Absolutely.
And every time I go to the Met, I am dumbfounded by how ridiculous that museum is. There is so much stuff in there that it just makes your mind ache.
Yeah, you can't do it. I don't think you can do it in an afternoon. I think it takes multiple trips.
Yeah, it's an afternoon per area. You know, if you were really going to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, what I do is I just do these. You know, I'll go in for a specific thing or two, and then I'll also kind of walk around and see the stuff that are my favorites. You know, while I'm there. Anyway, turns out they had a whole thing about the street, and they had this video by, I can't remember who did the video. I'll have to look it up. A guy got, what are those super high speed cameras that people use? You know, the Phantom?
Phantom, like the super slow motion. She's 25,000 frames per second or something.
So the guy got one of those and drove around in a car or a cab in New York City and took video of just people on the street as he's driving down the street.
At super, super slow motion?
Yeah. Well, super, super high speed, and then slowed it down
right.
And cut like, I don't know, 6 hours of video down to 1 hour of stuff in slow motion.
Neato.
And they look like high def. They look like photographs that are moving. I know that that's what movies are, but.
So they're almost like moving pictures.
Yeah. No, you know what I mean? It's almost like a scene that's kind of shifting over time. It's fascinating to look at. And it kind of got me thinking, and then he had like Thurston Moore do the music or something like that. Because he's, whoever this guy was, he's friends with him. And what I found fascinating by it was everyone was just riveted by it. And the reason I bring it up is that it kind of made me think about the fact that that photographers doing video, the thing that I always rail against a lot of times, or this insistence that photographers do video. Part of my problem with that is that I think standard sort of moving images, cinematography stuff is done by cinematographers who sort of specialize in that kind of thing. But I think that there is a place for photographers to use moving images to make something different, something more than just moving images. Does that make sense?
But something not really.
More. Okay. That photographers making video art is interesting to me in a way that photographers making just video, like making
rather
a movie,
than event videography or something.
Yeah. Or even just making movies. Like if you're going to do something that is essentially a photograph that's in motion, that's interesting to me because that's a natural extension of what this guy probably did if he was a photographer.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
James Neris. I wonder if you could see this online anywhere.
Yeah, you can. I just pasted the
link.
But
the video doesn't play, does it? Oh, yeah, it does. There it is. Perfect. Yeah, and this is like really, really, it's really, really cool, especially on a big giant screen. Anyway, it's just kind of neat. It makes me want to get a Phantom. Do you want a Phantom?
No.
You don't like those things?
You know what? That's not where my head's at. I appreciate it. I think it's interesting if it's done well, but I guess you could say that about anything.
Right.
It's just not in my grid.
This thing was done pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt very artsy. It also is interesting because I go around the corner and there is a William Eggleston show of original dye transfer prints from stuff from the 70s, basically also from the guide.
Yeah.
And, wow. Yeah. And they were really something.
Now, how large are these prints?
Not big at all. 11 by 14, 11 by 17, like that kind of size.
Hmm.
Maybe 13 by 19, you know, that medium size prints.
Now, how do they look, Bill, aesthetically compared to his recent work?
Or his photographs?
The prints. You had mentioned the qualitative differences between dye transfer and pigment.
Right.
Well, I guess just call them inkjet prints because that's what they are.
You mean glycy?
Yeah, or giclée.
I think that the dye transfer prints with the right photograph can look really good. They have they have like a level of saturation and sort of depth to them that's a little bit different. That said, I think that a modern, really good inkjet print is as good as pretty much any print that I've ever seen.
So what is the difference, like?
One could argue that the difference is in the craft of making it, right?
Sure.
And by one, I would mean you would make that argument. You would, wouldn't you?
I am a fan of the process, yeah.
Right. So, you know, the idea that there are only five of these things because the guy only made five of them is interesting or what have you. They looked good. I didn't walk in there and go, oh my God. Like, you know, I can't believe people haven't seen things like this before.
Right.
It wasn't like that. But they're sort of, you know, you go up and you stare at them and you kind of go, wow, you know, that really is a beautiful thing. A lot of his pictures too, that are like sort of the famous ones, like that woman sitting with her legs crossed on the thing outside, smoking a cigarette.
Mm-hmm. You know,
it's actually, they're not technically very good photographs. You know, it's a little out of focus and there's image blur because, you know, she's moving her hand at the time and you know what I mean? Like they're not perfect in some way. Not that they should be, but you know,
by what you're going to say, they shouldn't be.
No, I think we all tend to, especially in the digital age, analyze our photographs and rip them apart for technical deficiencies, which we shouldn't.
I agree. I agree. In fact, one of my favorite Eggleston photographs is the one where we're just looking at the back of the woman's head in the cafe, in the like the turquoise booth.
Yep,
I love that shot.
You love turquoise booths.
I do. It is a thing. No, it's the brick wall too.
So that was really cool, and so it was a good time, right? So then, this is where it gets messed up.
This is where it gets messed up.
Right. No, this is seriously where it gets messed up. So Heather and I go around the corner. A few months ago, we watched this series of shows on the Impressionists.
Okay.
Which I think I can put in the show notes if I can find it. Which is a mini-series that this guy did, a show... Painting and Revolution, The Gang of Four is called. I'll put a link in the show notes. By Waldemar Januszewski. You know this guy? Some art writer.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. So he talks about how all of these guys, these impressionists were rebels. People look at them now as, you know, this is the painting on the box of chocolates and on the umbrella and the poster that you put on a wall when you're a girl and going to college and whatnot, right? Like you're totally going to buy a Monet poster for B when she goes to college, that kind of thing.
Okay.
You're not going to do that?
No.
Okay. and it was a really good show. And the guy was talking about how, you know, these people were rebels and they were, some of them were poor and some of them were rich, and they lived off each other, and like really kind of brought them to life as people that were more than just, you know, these thin one dimensional things of like, oh, Monet, look, and then he got old and got cataracts, and that's why
right,
he
was painting. Right, right.
You know,
okay.
It was more than that. And there were a number of paintings in there that he was pointing out as like these seminal works, right? So we're walking through the museum, and there was a show going on called Impressionism and Fashion or something like that.
Okay.
And
no, wait, this is still at the Met.
At the Met. Right. And I wanted to get through that to get to something else. So I was like, oh, I think we can go through this. Because I'm not a huge Impressionist fan, and I'm definitely not a huge like fashion fan. I don't really care to go see dresses.
Okay.
Right? It's just not my thing. So we go around the corner, and the place is loaded with paintings from this BBC show that are all these seminal works.
Oh, wow.
Including a bunch from Musée d'Orsay. So it's all this stuff from that I would never get to see unless I went over to Musée d'Orsay in Paris and saw them. Now, I had seen some of them because I'd been to that thing, but I didn't expect them to be, you know, Basile and Monet paintings and stuff that like, and Manet paintings that are from all over the world that they brought here just for this show.
Wow.
And it was amazing. You know, from the National Gallery in DC, from places out west, from places in Europe. It was like one of these situations where stuff came
beautiful.
Stuff came from all over the world. And it made me think two things. It made me think, one, if I had gone to Paris to go see this painting and it wasn't there because it was in New York, I really would have been really pissed.
A little card on the wall.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. It happens, right? But it also reminded me, like, holy crap, this is why I live where I live. You know? Because I accidentally stumbled upon this thing that is this amazing collection of stuff that I would have never seen otherwise.
Right.
And it made me realize that, first of all, there's a lot of Impressionist paintings that are very photographic in sense and style.
Sure.
You know? Some of which are so photographic that I think that it may have been a time when people started using photographs as reference. You know, how did painting change when they could have pictures of people to work from, as opposed to having people sit for them all the time and doing it from
right,
sketches?
Right.
You know, and I think that things changed a lot because these paintings start as things go from the 1870s and 1880s and 1890s, things changed in the paintings in such a way that they look more and more like photographs unto themselves. Just as at the turn of the century, photography was really coming, starting to come into its own.
Well, there's a degree, there's a noticeable change in nuance and fine detail.
Sure. But do you also think that obviously there is a case to be made for this, but you know, that at the point at which photography took over, painters said, we don't need to recreate reality anymore. And that's what led to the modernist stuff. We need to do something that photography can't do by recording reality. We need to perceive reality and translate it in such a way that it becomes something more than, something even more human than reality is naturally.
Sure. I think there was that.
I mean, that was a change in that became a change in music when things became less tonal. You know, that was sort of the whole modern movement in music in the early 20th century, in photography and dance. And I think it's interesting that ultimately a lot of that stuff comes down to photography. I think
as an influence or kind of a kickstart.
Well, because photography for visual stuff, sound recordings, you know, movies, the point at which you can record a performance that changes performances, you know, because you don't have to go see music to hear music. So that when you go see music, it has to be something more than you could have gotten on the record, you know,
Okay. Rabbit hole.
Yeah, sure.
When you go to a concert and they play it the way it is on the record, does that, do you feel cheated? Should there be some straying? Should there be some more improvisation, or should they
depends
make
on
it
the
sound
artist.
Like it was on the record?
Yeah, it depends on the artist for me.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think, you know what, you should have just stuck with the record. But then sometimes you listen to somebody. I went to see Norah Jones when she first hit years ago,
mm-hmm.
like her first record. And I'd bought the tickets because I had heard one of her songs on a soundtrack or something and said, oh, man, I got to go hear that girl. And by the time I went to see her, they had added 5 shows at Town Hall because, you know, her record had blown up. And she was up on stage and her just playing the stuff straight because her band was really good was beautiful. You know, just hearing it live, her voice just kind of blooms, you know, in a space like that.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm okay with, you know. But yeah, at a certain point, it's like I have a really, really good stereo. I could sit at home and listen to this stuff. And a lot of times I do, especially with like jazz stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, I can go see live jazz, and live jazz is a totally different thing. But then you got to be annoyed by the people clinking glasses and talking, and you know, it's like, can I spend $45 for this? You know?
But the performance, I mean, to just to kind of highlight jazz for a minute, the performances are often so different.
Yeah, and
seeing a track live.
True, but you know what? A good live recording of a jazz thing is great too. You know,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And especially if you have a system that can handle that kind of thing and recreate it in a way that it feels like you're actually in the room, though, that's a whole different thing. You had a question about my favorite concerts, weren't
best,
you?
Yeah. Best concert you ever saw.
The first concert I ever saw was Bruce Springsteen Born in the USA when I was 9. That was a pretty good show.
Mm-hmm. I have seen Bruce. He is epic.
I am a huge fan of Billy Joel and have seen him a number of times, and he is fantastic live. Especially back in the day when he was still, you know, not fat.
Does that somehow lessen how talented he is?
No, but you know, I don't think he moves around or jumps on his piano the way he did 20 years ago. You know who I saw once that was really amazing, so amazing that I went back and saw her again. Anne Murray.
Really?
Oh, did an amazing show.
Okay, first concert ever?
Yeah.
Air Supply.
I love Air Supply. A friend of mine once was on a plane to India, and he like got bumped into by some guy with an Air Supply leather jacket on. Right?
Right.
And he's like, and so he's just like, who the hell would wear an Air Supply leather jacket? And the guy sits down, and it's the guy from Air Supply.
Oh, nice. Nice.
They were flying to India to shoot or to do a show.
That's funny.
Which is pretty genius. Yeah. There was one other one that I wanted to say though.
For U2 up there for me.
I've never seen U2 live.
Saw Joshua Tree and it was amazing.
I respect U2 a lot. I don't listen to their albums all that much.
I don't listen to them much anymore.
Yeah.
Sting is really good live.
Okay. I can see that.
Excellent musicianship.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. Trying to think of somebody. James Taylor puts on a good show.
I've seen James Taylor,
and he sounds fantastic live.
Yeah.
It's you know what we are. We're proving.
Mm.
We're very old men.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. You know who was amazing? Pink Floyd.
I could totally see that. I've never seen Pink Floyd.
Amazing.
But see that, okay, but Pink Floyd shows are more than just people playing music.
Oh, it's theatrical. Yeah, yeah. It was hugely theatrical.
Exactly.
And my favorite shows that I've seen are Pink Floyd, David Bowie, and Springsteen.
Bowie.
Because they weren't just standing up there playing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Bruce, yes, he stands up there and plays, but he plays for 4 hours and he tells stories and sits on the edge of the stage and, you know, it's an experience.
Does it bother you if he's telling the same stories over and over again?
I've only seen...
If it's not spontaneous, like, oh, you know, it's funny. Hold on a second, guys. I actually want to tell this story that I just remembered. Like you and I talking about this right now, which is, you know, pretty spontaneous.
If every episode, four or five times, then I wouldn't want to.
Yeah. Where the point at which the shtick becomes part
right.
of the show.
Right. It becomes between Thunder Road and, you know, whatever, we're going to tell this. Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be kind of a bummer.
I'm pretty sure that stuff does happen, of course.
You know who I would love to have seen back in the day?
Oh.
Hall & Oates.
Oh. I saw Hall & Oates.
Were they amazing?
I saw Hall & Oates twice recently, like in the past 10 years.
Okay, first of all, Daryl Hall, still a monster voice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were great both times.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, Hall & Oates is...
Anyway, so sorry for the digression, but...
Yeah, how did we get there?
I don't know.
Okay, anyway. Moving on. What else do we got? All in all, the Met is interesting. It's also interesting when you're looking, say, through the pictures of Eggleston, or there was some Walker Evans stuff on the walls and that kind of stuff. It kind of got me thinking about the fact that that museums are this weird kind of bubble of time, you know, that we look at things and say, oh, that was shot in the 1970s, and therefore it has this sensibility. And, like, you know, we take it outside of the timeline of when it was created and put it in a little box with a label on it.
Sure.
And I think that that's a little strange, you know? You ever see things that are sort of artifacty? It's like, you know, some beat writer made this diorama, and here it is in a Lucite box.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, wait a minute, it's a shoebox diorama. You know what I mean? That, like, that we now give covet and give all of this importance to, you know?
I think in some ways it can work against the work, but I think in other ways, like film, for example, I love 70s films.
Okay.
Partially for the way that they look in terms of color palette and film stocks and the sort of grittiness, but just the way the cities looked. How San Francisco looked in the 70s, how New York looked in the 70s, Chicago in the 70s. That's an interesting time for me.
Yeah.
Visually.
You mean like Dog Day Afternoon?
Exactly like Dog Day Afternoon, which totally blew me away that you used to live in that building. That's pretty awesome.
I did.
Any of the Dirty Harry films set in San Francisco, or French Connection, or, you know, John Cassavetes stuff. It had an aesthetic to it that I don't think we've, even when we try and do period films set in the 70s, or any period really, but using the 70s as an example, it still doesn't have the same feel.
Right. No, I completely agree. But you know, as those examples are great because, you know, New York and San Francisco were completely different places back in the day, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we just have to deal with that. Like, that things have changed, maybe.
Right.
It's just kind of weird. But it just kind of got me thinking about, you know, is the photograph that was taken today on an iPhone going to be in a collection 30 years from now and be like, look at this thing from vintage 2013 print from, you know?
Yeah, right.
And it will, but that's just kind of odd to me that because we think that everything's been done, and we think that, you know, what we're doing now is so now, but now is very soon the past, you know?
Right now.
So why even think about that stuff too deeply? Because you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. One thing last, couple weeks ago when we did our little hangout, who was the guy who showed up late? Remember, there's a guy who showed up late. He's like, sorry, I was taking pictures of a scarf.
Oh, Fred.
Okay. And he was saying how he used this website, imagebrief.com.
Yes.
Where they put up briefs. They say, we need a picture of a blue scarf and we need it by tomorrow. And the budget is $1,000 to use for this thing.
Almost a curated sort of a curated stock.
Yeah, kind of it's an interesting thing. It's like trying to get, like, people who need pictures and people who have pictures together.
Right.
And the prices are fairly good for that kind of thing. And I thought the whole thing was pretty interesting.
It's a 30-70 split?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, you get 70%. And first of all, I signed up just so I could look through. And then I got an email from one of the women who run the thing, this woman, Meg, the wife, it's a husband and wife team who started it, saying that they were going to have like a little thing at a bar where they were going to get together with a bunch of the New York photographers and say hello, right? But I had, I was busy that night. So I wrote her back and said, you know, I'm busy this night, but like, I'd love to hear more about your thing and meet you and stuff. I do the show and blah, blah, blah. And so we had breakfast last week, and she's a total sweetheart. Let me just say that right now. And I heard their whole reasoning for doing this. She ran an agency selling like lifestyle and fashion pictures to people down in Australia. And they kind of came up, and her husband apparently is an entrepreneur, and they were just like, look, there's got to be a better way to do this. And they really see it as they don't want you to go shoot the scarf, though they're not going to stop you from doing that.
Sure.
What it more is like, do you have a picture of a scarf already in your collection? You know, show it to us here. And it's interesting because this gets us back to tagging photos the way we were talking about in the workflow the other day.
That's that thing you don't do, right?
That's the thing I don't do. But this would be a good reason to do it, but it would take a lot of time to do it, right?
Sure.
Right. So, but just very interesting. And, you know, I said to her, I said, you know, there's two sides to this. You are taking away from the stock market, and you are also taking away from the high end, we're going to find a photographer to shoot this thing for us market, right? You're somewhere in the middle. Where do you see yourself eating away at, the bottom or the top? And she said, you know, I think her answer was neither or a little of both, that they think they imagine themselves not putting stock out of business, but also not putting really high end stuff out of business, that they're just sort of trying to connect buyers with people who have photos. And I, you know, I came away, we had a long discussion. There's a lot more to it that I won't bring up here, but I came away kind of feeling like they had a good idea. And I think that it's elevating photographs from being worth nothing to being worth something. And I am all for that.
Look, yeah, I think it's a great idea. I think the business model is interesting. I don't think there's any danger of Getty going out of business from it.
I agree. No, it's not. No, Getty's not going to go out of business, but that's fine. Getty can do the thing.
Will it inspire Getty to maybe change their model or offer a similar service if they see success coming from it? Maybe.
Her argument was, you know, I have art buyers who are looking for, say, pictures of babies, right? And they use Getty and they use Alamy and they use all these other ones, and they've seen every picture of a baby that's in those collections.
Sure.
They want something different, something that's not stock, but they don't want to pay $20,000 to fund an entire shoot to take a picture of a baby.
Right.
So there's got to be something in the middle. And you know what? That something in the middle makes sense.
Yeah. No, I think it's a fine idea.
So anyway, it's very, very cool.
And it's nice to know that they are cool folks behind it.
Yep. Very, very thing. So imagebrief.com, check it out. She did say, though, that they, you know, if you sign up, there's a certain, they accept or decline people to even sign up. Like they go look at your portfolio and
before
they,
you're even allowed to sign.
And when you submit pictures, like you have, like they're looking for a picture of a blue scarf and you put it in, they have people who take a look at it and can reject them. Even the submissions and they can recommend it to the people, say like, oh, this is a good one. So they can sort of shortlist certain things.
So almost like you get almost an account rep working on your behalf.
So the 30% that they're getting really isn't just like for the transaction. They are actually doing work.
That's pretty cool.
In the middle. Yeah, it was really interesting. Anyway, imagebrief.com, you should check it out. I think it's a cool business. What else we got?
You know, I've got $26,000 to $33,000 burning a hole in my pocket, Bill.
I'm sure you do.
Do you know what I can do with it?
Well, you could come visit me in New York City. Oh, you wanted to buy Eisenstadt's camera.
Yeah.
It's a Leica 3A. You want that?
This is the one he used to shoot the kiss in Times Square.
Yep. Yeah.
So, you know, isn't that the way it is? All you need is the right gear and then you will be a good photographer.
Just buy Eisenstadt's camera and you too can take pictures.
You too will be an amazing photographer.
Yeah, I saw this. It's interesting. I don't know that I would pay $20,000 or $25,000 to own a camera like that. But, you know, people who do, that's cool. That's an old Leica. That's before when you had to, like, calibrate the rangefinder and stuff. That was a lot of work, that camera.
Yeah.
It's even more manual than the manual camera you think is manual.
I will stick with my Fuji. Thank you very much.
A very pretty camera, though. And interestingly enough, apparently he used them, like, until the day he died. He shot Clinton and his family in 1993 with it.
Wow.
So he was using the same thing with that little clip-on VIOH viewfinder.
Yes.
Which is this crazy thing with extra frame lines and stuff in it. It's pretty cool.
So wait, the little viewfinder's got little bright lines in it?
Yeah.
Wow. Neato.
Yeah. Pretty cool stuff, but a lot of work. But kind of neat. You can get these old Leicas pretty cheap, but... nowadays you have to like cut part of the leader off 35 millimeter film because they've added more leader over the years and it screws it all up.
Mm.
It's pretty cool stuff. Hey, I took that Hadouken photo.
You did? Bam! Just like that.
I put it up in the Google Plus group and on Twitter and whatnot.
Who is the young lady that's in there?
That would be Iran Buggy.
Because she's the same dancer, right?
Yep. Yeah,
same girl that was in one of your December project photos.
She was the one dancing on the ceiling in the picture with the cat. The cat, by the way, passed away 2 weeks ago. Very sadly,
Marmo. Bummer.
But yeah, so I got a group of people together, including a friend of the show, Francisco Graciano. Cisco is the one jumping up in the middle there.
Of course he is, like 18 feet off the ground.
Yeah, yeah, and he wasn't even trying for that one. I got him on his way up, right?
I love he's like the highest person in the group, and he's just like, meh.
Yeah, he's like, eh. Oh, you want me to jump? How? Literally, when I said jump, he said, how high? You know, if he wasn't such a nice guy, I would hate that guy. Anyway, had a good time. Did one of these shots, and I'm putting together a little behind the scenes. Claude shot some video when we did the shoot, and I did a little stop motion thing as I was working in Photoshop. So that's a little 1 minute thing. You can watch me actually finish the shot, but I haven't posted that yet. I will this week though. And I have one more to process, which is them on concrete with her slamming the ground. I did one of those too, but I wanted to get this one out first because it was fun. But somebody said it looked, I think Alan on the Google group said, you know, it looks like it's Photoshopped. And I was like, well, it better look like it's Photoshopped. It's a person with superpowers. If she didn't look Photoshopped, then we have bigger problems than the fact that it was faked.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was fun. So thank you for everyone that was involved. All right. Who's our photographer of the week?
Photographer of the week. Very talented young lady.
Oh, boy.
The lovely and talented.
Oh, boy.
Miss Cindy Sherman. She freaks me out, Cindy Sherman.
Yeah, me too. You think it's in a good way? A woman?
No, I just think it's because you never know who she is. You never know where. I mean, she could be standing right next to you in the museum looking at her work and you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
That's just kind of wild.
Do you like her work?
I like some of it, yeah.
Okay. Do you like the old stuff, like the movie ones?
Yes.
Okay. Do you think that was that original of an idea?
I don't think there are very many original ideas, no.
Okay.
But I think they were pulled off very well.
Do you think they deserve the acclaim that they've gotten?
I don't know. I mean, I never really, until fairly recently, never really realized how big she was in sort of the scene, in the art world.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that she was really, really big.
And by big, you mean enormous.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's so Cindy Sherman, if you don't know, sort of famous in the late 70s. She started early 80s. I guess it was, it was 77 to 80. She was doing them. She made 69 photographs called Untitled Film Stills, which are self portraits of her playing roles in movies that don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And these are very, very famous photographs now. So you've seen them. You've seen the woman with the hat on in front of sort of like a New York building scape, you know, looking like she's going to work, that kind of thing. Everyone's seen that, the shot of her in sort of panties and underwear laying on the bed. You know that shot?
Yep.
And these things are for some reason very, very highly regarded in art world. I personally don't necessarily see it, But I think it may be one of those things that's very much a reaction of the time. The one thing that people say is that she's a bit of a chameleon because she's in all these pictures, but she's playing different people, that kind of thing.
Yes.
I do like, I've seen the shot of her in like the plaid schoolgirl thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a big print of that and it was pretty cool, but you know, it wasn't like, I don't know how I feel about her. There's a little too much art world stuff in all of the stuff that she does.
But it's interesting because, and this is one of the reasons I find her so interesting, is because she's very much in, let's see how, she's more in the art world, I think, than she is in the photography world.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
She's an artist more than she's a photographer.
Right. And
she's
almost
a performance artist who photographs her performance.
Yeah. Which I find really interesting.
Yeah. Okay. It's interesting from, okay, let's twist
almost
this.
As a social experiment more than an artistic experiment.
Much in the same way that you could say that Warhol is interesting because of the concepts that he brought up are interesting. Like, you know, is art made by members of my factory, my art, and is mass production, like, can that work and actually still be, is rarity really the reason why things are, you know, mm-hmm. all those questions, mm-hmm. those are fascinating. Doesn't mean that I like Warhol's art.
Right. I think I am more fascinated by Cindy Sherman's career than her work.
Okay. I think that that is a reasonable thing. I think she also must have a really good agent or press people. Because I think her work is good, but I think that her renown is bigger than her work is good. You know?
Yeah. I mean, again, I didn't have a really accurate idea of how enormous she is in the art world.
Yeah. No, yeah, she's huge. I think at a certain point though, it's getting, I wonder if she's kind of got herself into a corner, cause she does the film stills and she does the books and she's, you know, that she just has to keep finding new ways to have herself in photographs. So she recreated paintings for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And did that kind of stuff.
Is it becoming shtick?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Is she just doing the same thing over and over again now?
It kind of feels that way. Is it kind of like Tom Waits?
You think Tom Waits does the same thing over and over again?
I think there is a danger of him kind of, you know, going into that kind of raspy character mode.
Okay.
That he has taken to a point where it's almost unrecognizable on some of his tracks.
It's almost a caricature.
Yeah.
That's why I generally prefer earlier Tom Waits before he got a little too vaudeville-esque.
Yeah. Hugely talented, but yeah. almost derivative of himself in the same way that to your point, Cindy Sherman has now has to, like you said, has to look for new ways to inject herself into her work.
Yeah, I think she's interesting. I think she's less interesting than her renown makes her.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly an important photographer and somebody
absolutely
that we can point to. And I mean, her website is a good 10 years old. Her website's terrible. But see, you know what's funny?
I'm getting there through CompuServe, so it looks pretty good to me.
Well, I mean, that's almost what it is, right?
Yeah,
it is. The funny thing about it is that the fancier the photographer, the less they have to worry about looking good on the internet because they're making lots of money and doing their things. You know, apparently, you know, one of her photographs sold for $3.89 million.
Yeah.
Last year.
Which?
Second highest price photograph ever.
Yeah, and I'm hoping to get back on top next year.
Like the Gursky pictures, I can almost understand. Steichen,
you see what I did there?
I saw that. I don't know. I really don't know. Interesting though.
Yeah, very.
So go, you know, talk about Cindy Sherman. I don't know, you know, discuss it in the group or send us an email if you completely disagree with us and think that she is the greatest thing since sliced bread. We want to hear from you. And tell us why.
Yes, please.
Where can people get a hold of us?
Where are we? Are we over?
We're good. I think we're done.
Are we?
Yeah, we
look at that.
We've been on for an hour and 33 minutes.
For the big anniversary show.
The giant, the supersized anniversary show.
Dun,
this
dun,
Sunday, Sunday, dun. Sunday. anything else?
Coming to a podcast client near you. podcast at ontakingpictures.com.
Yep.
You can find Bill if you're on the Twitter. He tweets at Bill Wadman. I tweet at Jeffrey Sidoris. You can also find him at BillWadman.com. You can find me at FadedAndBlurred.com. The Google Plus community is a good place to go get involved. And you know what else you can do? And this would be good. This is our anniversary gift to us that you can give. Go tell some friends about us.
Yeah, and again, go talk about us on the iTunes. Go give us a review. Yes, it's very helpful if people go tell other people about us. And I want double
the number of listeners.
Okay.
I want to see if we can get to 8.
Yeah. Look, if you run a blog or you're on Twitter or you have some sort of outlet, write a little thing about us and get the word out. If you like the show and if you need us to make some sort of comment, write Jeffrey and he'll write back to you with all the answers you want.
I will?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I will.
next week, we will cover some more stuff. Hey, send in questions, too. Let's do a Q&A. I think I think it's about time for a Q&A episode.
I think a Q&A and maybe revisiting some of the favorite episodes. What's been your favorite episode so far?
Yeah, I know what mine is.
I don't know what mine is now. Okay. I had one, but I don't know now.
Okay.
But maybe this one. I think every episode.
I know. That's the way you are.
Almost every show after we're done recording, I end it with, man, I think that was our best show yet.
Jeffrey,
don't go changing.
Oh, don't do that. We're gonna have to pay.
Oh,
money.
Right. Sorry. Yeah.
Billy Joel.
So we'll see you next week.
Yep. Have a good week, everyone. All right.